This evening, we are very privileged to have Tom Griscom, who represents two worlds. He worked in the high reaches of the Reagan administration, worked in the as a communications director, as the communications czar, and also worked in the Senate for Senator Howard Baker, and is the editor and publisher of the Chattanooga Times. So you can really tell us how those two worlds intersect and what some of the pressures are of providing the public with the information that they need. In looking at your two positions, did you see information differently and what the public needs for information? Like when you were in the White House, how did you look at that question of what information the public needs, and how do you look at it now?
I want to reverse your question, if you don't mind, because
sure.
One of the things when I got back into journalism after, I mean, that's where I started when I graduated from college, many years ago, to come back into a newsroom with people who had spent most of their time, you know, as journalists. That's what they had done. So they had a lot more experience mm-hmm. that way than maybe I had in knowing what the latest writing style were, things like this. But here's the point I made, Martha, at the time. I said, I wish there were more people in journalism who had done what I did. I mean, I'm a hybrid. You don't usually find people like me mm-hmm. who are allowed to come back into the fraternity, per se. But I wish there was more people like with the experience that I've had. Because here's what you bring in, an understanding of how policy works, how things get done, mm-hmm. The pressures that are applied, the special interests, all the things that go in, and the fact that journalists get spun just as much as anybody else. They get leveraged by, you know, a mm-hmm. phone call or somebody pushing a point of view. And I said, if you can understand that what happens with the way stories are told, mm-hmm. how you gather information. Now, you're going to sit there and think that nobody influences me at all. And I said, let me tell you, I did. Mm-hmm. That used to be what I did. I will come to that in just a second. But I said, so step back and think about this. If you've got a story that's being done about, let's say, Bowater, which is a company that's down in our area. It's a paper manufacturer. And so you've got a lot of environmentalists that talk about what Bowater uh-huh. does, and, you know, in clear-cutting things like this. And so you get this information, and your natural tendency is you're going to run with that without checking the facts. And you're not going to necessarily tell readers, who is this group that's put out this information? Who funds them? Mm-hmm. What is the agenda that they have? I said, you ought to be just as focused on telling that part of the story. Let readers decide then, after they know, here's who this group is, mm-hmm. here's what Bowaters does as a company. Put all that information out there, because that is part of telling this story. I said, now, it's not that I'm so smart myself, but it's part of having watched how decisions get made, the influences come to bear as a White House or Congress gets ready to act on something. Shouldn't you be telling the whole story? And part of that, I said, comes from the experience that I had in government. Now, when you go back then, let me take the first part of your question. I think the most difficult part, and one of the things that we were talking about briefly with Tony Snow getting ready to come in as the new spokesman at the White House, is you have to understand there is a very different world when you're a reporter looking in than when you're a spokesperson looking out. Mm-hmm. And some of the very same people that Tony Snow has worked with, you know, as a commentator at Fox News are now adversaries, not necessarily in a bad sense, but they're out trying to tell stories. Mm-hmm. And so relationships change. Mm-hmm. And what a Tony Snow is trying to do is to, you know, is to take a set of facts and present them from an administration's point of view. You're an advocate now. You've got to sort of take a set of situations and try to pitch them as best you can. And the balance that he's got now, I think any good press secretary's got to understand, or a communication person who, you mm-hmm. know, inside a White House, is where does your credibility start and stop?
Yeah.
I mean, we went in during Iran-Contra, and we had some clear understandings of would we ever go to a point where you knowingly told a lie? And the answer was no. And I think that's why today, I consider today, and you and I have had this conversation before, and say at no point in my career, which was, as you said, was in the Senate and then in the White House, did I knowingly put out information that was not credible or was not factual. And because at the end of the day, all you have is really your own reputation.
Right.
And whether that matters or not, it should. And then you have to decide if it gets to the point of whether, if you know there's information you've been given that's not accurate, do you put it out or do you say, I can't do that? Because then you have a choice. And I think the choice isn't that you go out and scream and get yourself in the media. The choice is that you decide that, I'm going to go do something else. But just because I can't deal with that, I'm not going to put out something I know is false.
But what responsibilities do you have, say, as a communications director or as a press secretary, to dig down and find out what the facts are? Because it's very difficult to do. You just, if you talk to a public affairs person, which, they have regular calls with public affairs people, and they're going to always give the rosy picture.
Right.
And so how do you dig into the bureaucracy and make sure that you're getting what you need to get?
Well, that is hard, because if you're in the White House, I watched the story developed about the about turning over the ports and the port security to a company in Dubai. And I kept waiting for somebody in the White House to say it was vetted, but if there are so many different interagencies that touch a decision, and what it says is that the White House staff didn't function.
Right.
Because there is a coordinating position inside the White House where all this comes together. It does rise to the top, because here's the President of the United States, you expect that he will know. But there are so many different people and players that what it told me was that the way the White House was set up to operate, there was there were a couple missing pieces, so you needed to somebody needed to come in and sort of look at that and decide at the end of the day, you could at least say that there was an awareness inside the White House before that decision got made, because we just had a decision within the last week where this time the president actually looked at it. So somebody got the message that you have to be able. Because in the White House, when we were in there, there was a staff secretary, and that was staff secretary's job, move paper.
Mm-hmm.
And there was paper that got moved that got to to a certain level where within the White House you knew what was going on, but that was one of the breakdowns that I saw. That there were some things just really not functioning. And it isn't a matter of what I'll call of control; it's a matter of needing to know. And making sure that a decision like this, which is a fairly sensitive decision, had a lot of potential security ramifications, but also had a congressional, a real congressional piece to it, that the systems had broken down.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if one of the things that was at the back of it in this administration, the system that Card wanted to set up, was a compartmentalized system where everybody had their job, that they would have a responsibility to do X and Y. And so they took care of that particular part.
Right.
But that the integration of all of it was lacking in some times. Because there were times, for example, when you'd have an economist come out and say, like the guy who was the council of Economic Advisors, head of the Council of Economic Advisors, who was saying that outsourcing really, worked pretty well. And so that report, you could say, you probably have to rephrase that. And so say in the Clinton administration, you had, as I guess most Democratic administrations, a lot of redundancy. You just had so many people involved in everything. But the result of it was that people had a little more political sensitivity of when they were going to run into trouble. And so the economic reports were always run through them.
For an administration that really has tried to sort of clamp down on who can speak and leaks and things like this, for it to have had as many sort of what I'll call bumbling episodes, you want to ask the question, were you so focused on shutting off the spigot that you didn't worry about just the basics of how information gets, you know, gets disseminated?
Right.
I mean, when we went inside the Reagan White House, it wasn't that things were out of control necessarily. It was really making sure that things were vetted and that there was some idea of what was getting ready to happen, when it's getting ready to happen, and being able to manage that information flow. We've talked about before that when we went in and then Chief of Staff Don Regan had said his mission was to let President Reagan be President Reagan, which meant just whatever he wanted to say and do, let him go do it. When in effect, if you really understood President Reagan, that the White House had been set up, even his governor's office in California was set up the same way that he had been as an actor. That here was his role, but he had always had people around him who were there to manage things, whether it was scripting or things like this. And when you took those away, that all of a sudden what happened is that you had, similar to what I think we've seen a little bit in this White House, is things just sort of happening out here without somebody really understanding how to manage them, how to make sure it was all came together, and that you had a focal point on what you were doing. And that to me is what was surprising, Martha, to watch a lot of what was happening here. I think you have, the way you describe what Andy Card was doing, he's a great guy, really a really good person. But a White House staff is designed to make sure that there's no surprises.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of Senator Baker's rules from the beginning when we went to work with him. No surprises. You're going to have a latitude to do a lot of things, but at the end of the day, make sure that there's not a surprise because something just fell through the cracks.
Do you think that that there is an inherent problem when you're very focused on a message and everybody's got their responsibilities relating to that message and taking it out, that it becomes difficult to listen?
Well, I'm not sure this administration's been that much focused on a message. I mean, there have been times, and I'm looking at it now as an outsider, as a newspaper editor and publisher, of where you scratch your head trying to figure out, well, what are they really doing this week? I mean, when the whole, when Congress and the country moved off of Social Security and they still had the president out there talking about privatizing Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I was going to still have that message, we just had a report that just came out earlier this week about Medicare and Social Security still being on path to go bankrupt by, 2040? Well, if that issue was important, then that'd be the time I'd be out there talking about it, because you've got a hook to build it off of. But it was watching it, sort of getting a sense that was there really a message, or were they just sort of out there, putting things up against the wall, and trying just to sort of go back to some consistent themes, but themes that had so far passed through that you just wondered, Was there a real focus on this message?
Right.
I'm not sure.
Because as they began, they talked about, one, Social Security was in trouble, and number two, they thought that the retirement accounts would be a good idea. And the two, I mean, right from the start in the briefing room, reporters pointed out that one didn't relate to the other.
Right.
And how can you sell these two things together? And they just hung with it no matter what. And if you look at the polls, that the support for it was less. I mean, it was 60 cities in 60 days. Although it was kind of like 600 cities because they sent out so many people. But by the end, the support was less than when they began.
Well, we were talking earlier about making sure that people inside a newsroom understand context and history. This administration is in the middle of a war, and we really haven't had a country in the middle of a war. I mean, the skirmishes that went on with the Reagan administration, things like this, that's what they were. But we haven't been at war since Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was fascinating inside my newsroom to look at young people, for the first time in, what, 30 years, who were all of a sudden, you know, talking about their colleagues, their friends in college who had gotten into the National Guard as a way to pay their way through college. Now, all of a sudden, my gosh, they're getting called up. They had never in their wildest dreams ever thought that they would actually serve. And we had this, when the Iraq War was getting ready to start, we had a meeting of our news staff and to talk about covering a war. I mean, we did embed a reporter in Iraq for 6 months. But just some of the stories and things we're going to do as a startup with reporters who knew nothing about the various branches of government and the difference in insignias and ranks among the various branches. So we had this conversation. This is a room with about 50 people in it, and there were three people in that room, including myself, who'd ever served in the military. Mm. Now, and I've got a room full of baby boomers, like most newspapers are going to have. Then you sort of bring it back from that. And I was startled to realize that in this room, that I've got people who are getting ready to cover something, most of whom have no context for any, you know, understanding the military, how it works, these type things. So you take that and then say, all right, here's an administration now that is in the middle of trying to steer and direct a policy at the time we're back at war. And you want to say, I wonder if they spent any time understanding, going back and looking at what was happening during the Kennedy administration, Johnson, Nixon, a country at war. What was different? Could you get people focus on other things than worrying about, you know, what's going on in that case in Vietnam, now it's worrying about what's going on in Iraq, and how do you sort of put that in context at the same time you deal with other issues? Now, one of the advantages, this administration right now has got an economy that is doing pretty well if you take the gas piece out. But if you look at their numbers are in the tank. And partly because I don't think they really have been able to understand how to talk about the war in Iraq and to sort of bring a focus to it at the same time that they're trying to push. I mean, it seemed like such a separation. Say, I'm going to go out and talk about Social Security reform at the time that you're fighting a war in Iraq. I mean, it was sort of like this just gigantic disconnect.
Do you think part of it, too, is that the White Houses reflect a president rather than compliment it, that no matter how many people he hires, those people are going to reflect his strengths? So say in Reagan's case, you all had a really strong communications operation, and it was just state of the art. But then when Bush came in, George H.W. Bush came in, he was not interested in communications, and he let all of that go. He didn't even talk to the people about staying on because he wasn't interested in that. So he didn't have an operation like that. He had a press operation, and Marlin was great, but it really was just a press operation, give out the information rather than do the other. And that in this administration, while the president is interested in the whole concept of communications, his idea is you make decisions and you tell people what the decisions are. You don't go through explaining what were the alternatives, what was the problem, how did you get there. And if the president's not going to do that, he has a staff that reflects that as well, that they can't be better in that than he can.
No, I think you're right. I mean, one of the first things Senator Baker said when he went as chief of staff for President Reagan, he said, people need to understand, you know, that Ronald Reagan is president, I am not. And that was important because at the time that Senator Baker went in, President Reagan had surgery, Iran-Contra had happened, he had been out of the public eye for months. And his former colleagues on Capitol Hill in the Senate were thinking that, well, Senator Baker was going to come in and he's basically going to be the de facto president because President Reagan had vetoed a highway bill. I mean, we're talking about pork today. I mean, come on. I mean, again, I go back to context. I mean, here was a highway bill that was just chock full of stuff. President Reagan had vetoed it somewhat symbolically, and Senator Baker's former colleague said, we know that when he gets there, he is going to convince the president that this is a bad idea and that everything will be okay. Well, didn't happen. They overrode the veto, And it was about as negative a reaction to Senator Baker as you could imagine, because his former colleague said, well, Don Regan would have been better than this. And that's when Senator Baker said, well, they have to realize he is president, I am not. Mm-hmm. And I think, and that's to your earlier point, you know, there is this misconception at times that, well, the person in the office is sort of, you know, is sort of there as a figurehead. Well, no, he's really the president of the United States, and that's where it all, I mean, it all revolves around that. And you're right. With one, I want to add one piece, though, to your description of what happened with both Bush 41 and Bush 43, is the communications today are so different than when we were there. I mean, we were there in 1987, 1988. If you look at what has happened with the explosion of the Internet, with the, I mean, communication that is instantaneous. And so therefore that you don't have the same amount of time to sit there and ponder something before it gets picked up and it's moved someplace else. You didn't have bloggers then. You know, all these people with computers who become overnight experts on whatever topic, and there are people, unfortunately, I will say, who believe, you know, what some people will sit down at their little computer and write, whether it has any basis in fact or not.
Yeah.
But we've allowed that to happen, and we've allowed a lot of that to happen by talk radio, things of that nature. Don't get me wrong, I'm a firm believer in free speech.
Mm-hmm.
But you would like to be able to say, yeah, but not all speech is exactly the same, because some people are out there, yeah, and there's ulterior motives for what they're doing or whatever. But I think communication has changed so much, the way you get messages out has changed so much, that when Ronald Reagan would talk about, as he did, you know, I'm going to go speak directly to the American people, I'm going to bypass Congress, because you remember those days when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, and he felt like, well, the House is going to try to block some, so I'm going to bypass all of you all, and I'm going to talk directly to the American people. He would do it, had a great mechanism set up where they could get a response vehicle that would just flood congressional offices with reaction.
Yeah.
It was all a political operation. Right. Well, today, if you say I'm not going to talk to the media, let's say to the mainstream media, well, it doesn't really matter, because there's so much there's so many other ways to capture events, to have people covering something, to get it out there so quick, that you have to have stayed up with that, you know, with the way information gets transmitted. And you know, it isn't just, you know, it isn't just what is on the networks or the New York Times or Washington Post, you know, this type of media. It is so diffuse now that if you don't understand how to work it, I mean, remember the regional news conferences that presidents used to have. I can remember this with President Carter, where you'd bring correspondents up from newspapers around the country.
Yeah.
Well, you don't need to do that. I mean, look at what we're doing tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a White House today, if they're not sitting down using this kind of technology, which they're not, to say, I'm going to string together and we're going to bring the President of the United States or these policymakers right into your newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do instantaneous ed boards.
But that's how
you take the message, and it's how you work it. That's how you sort of get it, and I think in touch the kind of people you're trying to reach. But you've got to be willing to understand how information gets out now. And you do give up a measure of control, but I'm not sure there's much control left anyway, Arthur, with how broad the spectrum is that you can communicate today.
But don't you need that White House press corps? I remember I was in College Station, Texas, when the energy plan was released. And the article in the College Station Eagle was written by Terry Hunt, who is at the White House for Associated Press. And that, and if you look at the blogs depend upon newspapers and a lot on what's going on from the White House, you know, if White House reporters writing. And you look at cable, you know, where is cable getting its stuff? You know, it's getting it from newspapers as well. So newspapers are still very important, and the people at the White House are critical. And so you've got to deal with them.
You do, except I think that the media is going is going through such a transformation, and we're not sure, I don't think anybody yeah. knows yet where it's going to end up. White House press corps had personality. And characters. I'm not sure the White House press corps today has the same character and personalities. And I think that's a step down. Doesn't mean, you know, the Sam Donaldsons of my time mm-hmm. could really get under your skin, but Ronald Reagan used Sam Donaldson as a foil, just like Sam Donaldson used him to sort of build his career. There was this give and take, and you know, it'd get people angry, but it brought a personality and a sense of character to the press corps. Now it's just, I have to say, it's somewhat bland. And it's not saying they aren't good journalists, but I think, unfortunately, it's reflecting what's going on in the media. I mean, if you look at a lot of the network news now, if you look at, are there real correspondents necessarily on Capitol Hill, or do they more have producers and things, they'll run somebody up there every now and then to cover something, yeah, it's more the latter than the former. Mm-hmm. Used to, Capitol Hill was the proving ground for somebody to move from there to go to the White House. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, what you've seen over time is a squeezing out, because newscasts have become more entertainment-oriented rather than some of that biting edge. And I think cable has caused part of that, but also I think some of the other competitors like Fox mm-hmm. have forced the other main networks to sort of move and shift direction with a large with what they do. And I worry about that, because mm-hmm. I think that you've got to, the role of the media, not just the newspapers, but the role of the media is to serve in that watchdog role, mm-hmm. is to be willing to ask the questions, be somewhat aggressive at times. You've got to find that boundary line where you don't cross over and become rude necessarily, but you can be aggressive yeah. without being rude. But all of a sudden you get blasted on by Rush Limbaugh or something like this, and you want to say, so what? Mm-hmm. But that takes a little courage to do that. I mean, our reporter who was embedded in Iraq got involved in a little bit of a back and forth when the question got asked by a National Guard soldier with the 278 about armor on Humvees. And we had done a story, he'd done several stories prior to Rumsfeld showing up, and coined the phrase hillbilly armor, where some of these soldiers went out into scrap heaps, found metal, steel, would cut it out themselves and put it on their Humvees before they were going to get ready, because they were getting ready to be deployed into Iraq. And so the soldier asked the question, our reporter, the soldier went to him and said, look at my question, whatever. We made a mistake, which I wrote about in our paper, because we should have, in the rush to edit the story, what didn't get put in there, because one of the editors thought that the reporter was going to put it in, the reporter thought the editor was going to put it in, because we're dealing with somebody now in Kuwait, that would have said, here was my role. Mm-hmm. That the soldier came after this, I looked at it, but it was his question. So we write the story, and...
You might want to tell them what the response was from Rumsfeld.
Well, basically, what he said was you sort of get the I'm trying to remember exactly, but you sort of get the
go to war with the
army that you have,
not necessarily the army that you want.
Yeah. And and so this story happens. Immediately, there's this bombardment from Rush Limbaugh, and Lee Pitts's father, who's in South Carolina, called me. And he wanted to, did I know what was, what was happening, what was being said? I mean, his son at that point was in a convoy going into Iraq, so he had no idea what was happening. And he said, Rush Limbaugh saying all these things, and basically that my son is not patriotic, and he's saying that if you won't fire him, then you ought to be fired yourself, and that you're some East Coast liberal. He's sure you're some East Coast liberal. And I said, well, Mr. Pitts, here's what you ought to do. I said, you ought to send him an email, and knowing I said, don't call him because you'll never get on, but know when you send the email, he'll never read it. But tell him who you are and that you've talked to this editor at the Chattanooga newspaper. And as best you can determine from having listened to him, he done psyches from the East Coast. And by the way, you might want to know that at one point he was a communication director in the Reagan White House. But I said, don't tell him I work for Howard Baker, because that would be, you know, he'd say, aha, you know, we found the terrible part of it. But I said, this, and then there was this campaign, orchestrated campaign that started. We got over 2,000 emails during this, you know, over about a 4 or 5 day period. And the first 500 were all negative. I mean, and these are so-called people who would be, you know, identified with the Christian right and all this. Some of the language, Martha, was incredible. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't surprised. But I had, you know, I mean, I know how you run these grass top campaigns, and I know where it got orchestrated. It came out of a national political committee here in Washington because they weren't smart enough, and I guess they didn't realize that maybe there was somebody on the receiving end, namely me, who knows how these things work. But then it turned. I mean, all of a sudden, because real people then started talking about it. But I also got some calls from people in the media that I'd worked with as a press secretary. And they had gotten caught up in the Rush Limbaugh line. And I said, you know, time out. I said, let me just tell you something. I said, if you did your research, you would see that we've run several stories on this issue. And yes, I'll acknowledge that we didn't do, you know, we should have put this in the story. But I wrote a front page piece where I said that, on the front of our newspaper. And I said, but here's the real issue in my mind is there a little jealousy here, because here's a newspaper in Chattanooga, Tennessee that's raised this issue, that's got this thing brought back up, and you are the, quote, national media, and you sort of let this story go away. It is not a news story. It's been out there. It got talked about in the campaign. And I found myself, believe it or not, back in the middle of the Bush-Kerry political fight. It was a red state, blue state issue, basically accusing us of being in the middle of trying to push forward the Democratic agenda. I said, you know, that is so wrong and so wrong-headed that I hope we haven't gotten to that point that we are, you know, when you raise a legitimate issue that is being viewed in a partisan prism, and therefore you don't even have a right to raise it or think about it, and we're going to go after the messenger rather than to talk about the message. Mm-hmm. I mean, is the message right? Did we have troops over there who didn't have the appropriate, you know, protection as they're getting ready to go into combat? And the answer was yes. I mean, I share that with you because it was a very telling episode. Yeah. But I found a lot of the people who are very respected journalists who fell right into the trap of just sort of Me Too-ism, saying, no, don't defend me, but be willing. Look at the story. Ask the question. Mm-hmm. And I go back, this is my roundabout way of getting to what you had posed a few minutes ago, is that I hope we don't get to the point where we've lost that voice, the characters, the willingness to be a little more aggressive, and we've lost it because, well, guess what? I may get pounded by a Rush Limbaugh type. A Fox News may attack me. But if your information is credible, then mm-hmm. stand behind it. Now, if you make gross errors, then yeah, you ought to be called to task for it. I mean, I do think there have been stories that have been done on some wild allegations that got picked up and presented as facts. I think that was very appropriate to do that. But don't become shy because somebody may raise a question about what I've written or said.
So do you think that that information is has increasingly, particularly say from the time that you were in the Reagan White House, that information is no longer neutral? That people tend to look at it through their own prism.
I think I think as much as we've seen the polarization in the country, red state, blue state, right. We've seen the same polarization in the media and trying to beat people down. I'm gonna go back to our embedding reporter in Iraq. Our reporter was there to do one thing, and that was to cover the 278, a 3,000 plus unit. National Guard soldiers, primarily from Tennessee. That was where he was. He was with them the whole time. We would keep getting stories or emails that why won't you all ever write anything good? Why don't you tell the real story about what's going on? And there was this email that was circle around about every 2 or 3 weeks of here's what's really happening in Iraq, all the good stuff, and it'd keep getting recycled. Mm-hmm. And I said, if anybody looked at what we were writing, we didn't have a person in Baghdad. We didn't want that. The stories for us to tell, because the only place you're going to find these stories were about the troops from Tennessee that had been deployed. Mm-hmm. And we told their stories. And they were not, all the same stories, that you were reading, covering the broader part of the war. And I'd sit there, and I'd write, columns every so often, in response to these faceless emails that come in about the media in this country doesn't tell the real story. And so then you're not reading what we're writing, because he is telling the real story. He's telling it from the voices and faces of these soldiers. And it was about going into communities and working with them to reestablish hospitals and things like this. But yeah, I think there's this a little bit, you become a little bit gun shy, because the polarization that we've seen politically, the polarization that I think exists up on Capitol Hill now, right, has been brought into the media, where you basically say, if you tell this story, then we're going to come after you. We're going to attack you. Mm-hmm. And I hope, Martha, over time, that the media does not fall into the trap where they say, well, therefore we're going to look the other way. Uh-huh. We're not going to cover that story. And because that, if that's what happens, then we've really made a mistake.
Do you think that's happening at the local level, or is it more at the national level?
I think it's more at the national level. I think at the local level, you've got. I think you still can see the ability to tell the stories because they're closer to home. Mm-hmm. These are people that you know, that you live with, you think about, but you don't find the same stark contrast that are being. I mean, at my newspaper, we will get a lot of people who will criticize us because we use the New York Times News Service. Our newspaper, part of our merged paper, is where the New York Times started. Adolph Ox started in Chattanooga. So the New York Times News Service has been part of the newspaper and will always be. I will get emails saying, well, we're going to stop reading your newspaper because you've got you use the New York Times News Service and we know that they're biased. Mm-hmm. And I say, thank you very much. We're going to keep using it because they're good journalists. So on national stories, yes. Mm-hmm. But if we do a story, we had an election Tuesday in our community, and a longtime sheriff of 20 years got beat by somebody in a primary, and you couldn't tell enough of that story. People were interested in it. Mm-hmm. But it's a local election. But if you get to the national piece, then you see, all of a sudden you pick up some of this, some of this overhang that's out there that you see, particularly in Washington. In the Washington community.
And we were talking before our session began about the concept of convergence and right. What is going on in the newsroom today and what you're doing to try to bring a lot of different pieces together. And can you talk about it? Because it's one of the main things that we've talked about in the course of how our newspaper is going to survive.
You've seen a lot of growth in major, news organizations, a lot of family-owned papers that now become part of big chains, and then those big chains, are are publicly held companies, and so you get this, what is your latest quarterly earning? The paper I work for is part of a seven newspaper chain that's still family-owned, privately held, which is great, because you can deal with the cycles, and there are cycles in our industry, just like there are in other industries. And so we're able to sort of work through that and continue doing the things that we ought to do, which is to offer good, solid journalism every day. The part that concerns me more than anything else is, we can be doomsayers and we can predict our own demise by telling people that newspapers are dead. Or we can say, look, circulation is dropping. We got to be smart enough to figure out how do we keep doing what we're doing, which is, you know, is providing you know, journalism and covering important stories that people need to know. And so how do we go do that? How do we keep making sure that we, you know, that we can, you know, provide that? Which means you step back and you realize that, you know, in local markets, it's newspapers that drive what people know. So I've got a newsroom, you know, that's got journalists in it. And if you start from the premise that if we can't figure out how to provide the income, the profit mm-hmm. stream that supports those journalists, then what does happen over time is they go away. When they go away, then television can't fill that void. Radio, we know won't fill that void. So journalism in this country basically diminishes. I do not think that will happen. But I think we've got to be smart enough to understand and be willing to bring inside newsrooms. I mean, Martha, when I came back and I've spent 30-plus years in some type of communication. I spent 9 years in a corporate communication job and have done PR, all this stuff. But one of the things in the corporate job that I understood was profit and losses. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back in and said, here's what we're going to talk about. We're going to bring some management tools in. We're going to actually do performance reviews. Mm-hmm. Because people all know how they're doing. They also know what expectations are there. But we also are going to be willing to talk and use the P word. We're going about profits. I mean, first time I raised that in the newsroom, you should have seen people's eyes say, oh my gosh, you know, they sort of did this. You know, we're writers, we write stories, we get to go home, we don't have to worry about where the money comes from. I said, well, yes, you do. Doesn't mean that you write a story to get an advertisement, we don't do that. But you need to understand good journalism can be sold, meaning content sells. You can sell content if you do it right. And so what we then embarked on, and really focus on it this past year, was how do you mm-hmm. sort of reconfigure what we do, which is produce content. The traditional model, if you know, as newspapers, is here's the newsroom. You put out a print product, and then everything else falls off the print product because we know that radio and TV steals our stories. It makes us angry every day because mm-hmm. we do all this hard work, and they read it like they had been doing all this work. And so we're going to show them. We're just going to sort of hang on to it, and we're going to put a little copyright symbol up there, you know, that forces them to say this news story came from so and so. Doesn't work. So then you have to step back and say, okay, once we get over our ego, and we accept the fact that what has gone on forever is going to continue, and that is that they're going to rip off our stories and use them. But guess what? That's what's happening with a lot of the search engines. They're ripping off our stories and putting them out. Everyplace else is their own.
Yeah.
So you get past that and say, what do we do? Well, we step back and we rethink our business. And you start with the basic point, we produce content. And content has value. People want content. If you look at what's going on, you still find a lot of people who are reading the news. They may not necessarily be picking up the newspaper every day, but they're looking for news. And if you want to know news about where we live, there's one place you're going to find it. So we've got a brand that's been out there for 100-plus years. People know what to expect. And if you believe over time, which I do, that people are going to migrate back, there's this proliferation of information. They're going to come back to places that they feel over time there's a confidence level in the information that's being provided. Mm-hmm. That's to us, or to any newspaper, if you really think it through and you mm-hmm. focus on this. So then what you do is say, let's talk about, we're content providers. That's what we are. So you reconfigure the whole organization chart. You say, let's take off this first box that says print first. You sit down and say, I've got content. Where does it go first? Mm-hmm. And if you look at what we're doing now, it's going to go online. We then are going to use the newspaper where you can take a story and you can put a second-day lead on it. You can provide more detail than you're going to get anyplace else. But then also I can take that same story and I can start thinking about one of the things I share with you. We're going to start a radio broadcast. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know the Washington Post has done this, but if I've already got the content, if I've got tapes where we've recorded people, then I'm going to go out and hire a broadcast person to work at a newspaper. And say, my gosh, you know, these are the people that steal our stuff. Well, no, We've got it now. We can go and work the same information and fill a void that no longer exists in our local markets. Mm-hmm. And that is, local radio news is no more. It's gone. Talk radio doesn't give local news. It's just a lot of talking heads. But you cannot go any place in Chattanooga and get local news like you used to be able to get 15, 20 years ago. Uh-huh. So we're going to take this content, we're going to put up a morning broadcast, we're going to put up a late afternoon broadcast that's got the final, you know, bell of the stocks and all this, put interviews, you know, pull sound bites off, have somebody who knows how to write radio copy, put that up as a podcast. You know, you can get it off our, you know, website, you know, however you want to receive it. I know, because we've already sold sponsorships for this. Mm-hmm. And then if it works, then we'll turn around, we're going to do a sports program, similar type thing. So all we're thinking about is it is what we talk about. I think 10 years later, I've got a better feel for what convergence means. Now, I'm also going to tell you that I don't think many communication journalism programs teach it yet. Because what I find, the University of Tennessee, they would say, you don't want to go into newspapers anymore because they're dying. So go off and become a magazine person. Well, last time I looked at magazines, they're sort of struggling too. And so all of a sudden, I put out a request a couple weeks ago. I said, I want to hire a broadcast person to work in a newspaper. And I get this, why would you do that? I said, because if you think about what we do, what we offer, then we have an ability to take it and spread it across an array of platforms. Mm-hmm. And what I haven't created is gone out and built a brand new building where I've got a little team that sits here that does internet, a team that sits here that does broadcast, a team that sits here and does newspaper, does print. Mm-hmm. And then they all three sit at a table, Martha, and they fight over who's going to put it on first. Mm-hmm. Because the newspaper person says, this is my story, it'll all be in print first, so I don't want it out here. Uh-huh. You know, nobody's going to see it. What you do is you bring them all together as one, in one entity, and you think through and say, I've got a story and I can now take it and tell it in different ways. We're working a project right now. Again, we're not doing things that much different than you'll find at other newspapers and other news organizations. We're doing a multimedia package right now as a first step into this. And when it comes out, we're going to offer print, audio, still, and video. Mm-hmm. And we're going to tell the whole thing. We're going to learn from it. And we're going to say, okay, we know now better how to do this, but we're not going to necessarily go out and start and become, you know, video camera people. My still photographers don't necessarily do that. But if we can see how it all works, then we can probably team up with somebody who does have that skill and attach them to a story. So what I'm now doing is I'm giving you, you know, film, giving you TV, radio, and print all in one package, in one place, with the same story, and it's all being put together at one time. That's where I think it, that's how I think it all finally evolves. And it doesn't mean that TV stations are going away or anything like this. What it does mean is that if you are smart enough and you have content, content will sell years ahead. And we've got to be willing to say, do I believe people still read print products? Yes, I do. But I wanted to offer it to you and to that person I don't know today who's out there in the way that you'd like to receive it. But I want you to know it's coming from me, and if we're smart enough, we know how to sell that, and the revenue's there that supports that core group, those journalists that produce, that are important to remain in place over time. That's where it all starts.
And so does it depend on advertising in each of those segments? Or
but it also depends. Well, for example, when we started, we got two podcasts up right now. We sold them before they went up. And so part of it is, it's the advertising people also have to rethink how they go out and sell something. And that's all. Sure. That's also part of this. Is it's very different to say I'm gonna go out now and I'm gonna offer you this. Audio broadcast once a week. We do one, it's on entertainment, but it's local entertainment in our market. Interviewing, you know, local bands and offering music that you can download, things like this. And you got to be smart enough to know, okay, I'm offering this. Now, who are the natural people that you would talk to advertise? And I'm going to show you the demographic I'm going after. Mm-hmm. And I can come back and show you, because they you know, they go in and they link into this, so they get it every week. It's rethinking it, very different than saying, I've got a product that I can tell you this many people see it, which mm-hmm. is a print product, versus I'm trying to walk you through, you know, a very different way. So advertising people also have to be brought along, and they have to rethink, you know, how they make their money, how they make their commissions, because a lot of them are a little reluctant to sell an internet piece, because it's very fluid, mm-hmm. And it is harder to quantify, you know, the eyeballs there, than it is, you know, being able to say, you know, here's an audited survey on your circulation, but mm-hmm. you can make it work. I mean, what we have seen since we moved to a much more aggressive internet strategy, our unique visitors and page views have they've gone up about 25% every month since we moved in this new direction.
Uh-huh.
And so we know the content works. Now you got to be smart enough to know how to monetize it.
Now, do you work with local television?
We work with local television on weather. Uh-huh. But what I found is that we're further ahead than local television with what we're doing.
Uh-huh.
Which, I mean, and not just in, not in terms of just how gathering the content, we're ahead of local television in our market in terms of some of the management and personnel issues. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it is very, you basically are telling people, trying to bring them along with you, to understand that we need to do this. You still got a great job. We're just going to ask you to rethink how you do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, when reporters come back now, think about it like it being a wire, you know, a wire service. We're putting out a quick update, which maybe is 30 to 60 words,
mm-hmm.
that goes out. But it's part of the process of time management. What you're doing is, rather than coming back and sitting for an hour or two, you know, doing whatever, you sit down, you get organized real quick, you write a short, very short, you know, summary of your story that gets posted on the website. But it's your beginning of organizing your thoughts of the story you want to tell. I mean, and so that part was, once we got to that, because the first question I got was, you're asking me to do more, but you're not going to pay me more.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you're right on the second part at this point, but we will pay for, you know, for the quality of what we get. I mean, we're not going to starve people at all. But what we're saying is, it's managing your time. And sure enough, that's what happened. Now, the radio piece, the reason I'm going outside, that's a much different proposition, because that's much more work intensive. So that's why I'm bringing somebody new in to do that,
mm-hmm.
because that really would have changed. I mean, if I've got a reporter on deadline and they've got an audio tape and they've got to make a choice, they're going to choose to get the story done that's getting ready to go in print,
right,
versus sitting there and fiddling around trying to find the interview that they did with you, and it may be somewhere in this 45-minute tape.
Yeah.
And so that's why we did go out and bring, you know, or looking for somebody new to come in and do that.
When you look at through your whole career, the kind of information that people get about the operation of government, and that's dealing with the government itself, what kind of information it does provide that it allows to be pried out, but also what news organizations give to the public. Do you think that there is a golden age of information? And if so, when?
Well, let me make one other point to your question. The other thing I find, which is a little disquieting, is a lot of people get turned off and tuned out on the latest political story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really don't want to know that much about, you know, the ins and outs of immigration reform. I mean, it's, you know, somebody will do a story that in 1986, when Senator Simpson and Senator Kennedy passed the last immigration reform, that what didn't, we are now seeing play out what didn't get cleaned up in 1986. Mm-hmm. This is the issues of today are left over from the 86 Immigration Act, and trying to deal with, you know, do we have illegal immigrants who ought to be in this country? Should they be sent back? What do we do about the borders? I mean, these are issues back in 86. Mm-hmm. But to get into this, yeah, you can probably say it. I mean, Senator Baker came, when he and I spent some time together last week with Senator Kassebaum, who's Mrs. Baker now, the three of us were talking about, because they both were around and seeing that debate mm-hmm. when it was occurring, and we're talking about and remembering the 86 issues that clearly at the time you wanted to pass something, but you knew uh-huh. that you hadn't done the whole job, and we're seeing now. But to get people to say, boy, I want to write about this, and mm-hmm. it is hard to get that story done. And for somebody to say, this is a process story, I really don't care. Uh-huh. You know, and when you see the biggest story 2 days ago was Anna Nicole Smith being able to go forward with her case, mm-hmm. and somebody, we were sitting in our news budget meeting, and my wire editor had it down there as the last subject matter, and he said, well, a lot of people be interested in this. I said, well, then they can find it. And we put it inside the paper, but I said, I'm not going to put this on the front page of my newspaper. Mm-hmm. Because I said, there was a lot of other things going on. We've got to find a way to make issues of government, both local and state and national, of importance that people want to read them. Mm-hmm. But that's, that's a concern I've got, Martha, is that we have allowed that to happen, and because what readers will tell you is, those stories are boring. I don't really care. If you give me another budget story, I'm going to just get turned off. We deal with this for local school budget stories, uh-huh. which can be really just tedious. And or the latest test scores that come out mm-hmm. on how students are doing. And so you want to say, yeah, the numbers themselves can be, but you can tell there's a lot of stories if you dig underneath that mm-hmm. and start talking about what these numbers mean. Yeah. And that's what I hope we find, that there's more interest in telling in looking at stories and finding that nugget that gets people brought into them. To your question, I think the nature and character of how people feel about politics and politicians is reflected in the way information is provided to them. When you are caught up in everything being partisan mm-hmm. and stark lines being drawn, that then the tendency is you shy away from those stories. Mm-hmm. You don't want to deal with them. I was one of the issues in the Senate race in Tennessee this year is whether one of the candidates is, when he ran against Bill Frist in 1994, was he pro-life or pro-choice? Mm-hmm. And I went back and looked at a book Senator Baker wrote prior to his running for president in 1980, and it was talking then about the abortion issue. Mm-hmm. And so now, this is an issue that's been out there for a long time, but is the most important issue, of a nuance between whether you were pro-choice, pro-life. Some people disagree with me on this. I said, I think I'd rather have somebody saying, let's go back and talk about the situation with gas prices, and why have we not, why have we not spent the money, done the things necessary to have the investments, or have we made the investments? What is it, and why are we going to do anything different this time than we didn't do 20 or 30 years ago? Mm-hmm. That's an issue that people, I think, really understand, except I can draw stark contrasts and divisions among people if I keep talking about abortion, because I can overshadow an mm-hmm. issue like, are we really serious about trying to find our way through in a dependence on foreign fuel supplies. Mm-hmm. and you know, it's that to me is part of what I think we're missing right now, mm-hmm. and don't find the desire for people to go out and really work those stories.
Uh-huh. Let's go to some questions. Towson?
Given the troubles that the Bush administration is going through at the moment, do you see any parallels between Iran-Contra and the current situation with the Bush administration, and what do you believe George Bush can do to pull out his poll numbers and have at least a successful ending to his administration?
All right, that's a good question. I don't think there's any parallel between when we went in with President Reagan. I mean, I talked to Senator Baker about this several weeks ago when he got a call to do a program at the time that the chairs were getting ready to be changed on the deck and bring in Bolton with Card going out. And, of course, the point being was if you bring Howard Baker in, you get the connotation that it's all about a political scandal, which is what Iran-Contra was. This president is dealing with issues and I think management-type questions, which we've talked about earlier. It's not so much of a political scandal a la Iran-Contra. Now, we consider, you can point to, well, you've had the questions about leaks and wiretappings and things like this. But they haven't raised themselves to the level that Iran-Contra raised mm-hmm. itself, where you had a very serious time of looking at whether the president potentially is going to be impeached over things like that. So that, to me, is a separation point between a political dynamics, political scandal that prompted the Don Regan going out and Senator Baker come in to the changes here. I think what you have in this case is I think it's important after a period of time that you need some fresh faces, some fresh ideas, some fresh thoughts. The White House is a tough place to work. I mean, I tell people this day, it is the hardest job I ever had, and I was in there for about 2 years. It is living in a fishbowl. I mean, it is realizing that how you show up to work, whether you're smiling or not, people read nuances into that. Your secretary can become a potential source of information. And again, if your secretary leaves all distraught, then they think, well, something must be happening. I mean, it is such a pressure cooker. And at some point, you need to be able to step out and to bring fresh thoughts in. So I think it's appropriate. I was somewhat, have to tell you the truth, amazed that some of these people have been there for 6 years. That's a mm-hmm. long time. For some of these people, not Scott McClellan, who clearly you had some changes in the press secretary's role, but in the case of Andy Card, he'd been there from the beginning.
Yeah.
Now, what does it take to back in your question, can President Bush's numbers bounce back? I think his presidency is now tied to a set of circumstances that are outside of this country. They're in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I mean, they chose to go in. You can step back and say, they may, the shock and awe that was there may be the phrase that they're trying to define, as this administration winds down. What was the shock and awe? And was part of the shock and awe what they were dealing with his administration. I worried, and this is somebody I'm speaking now, not in my position as a newspaper editor and publisher, but having been in government, having been around government, that the Defense Department fights wars. That's what they're there for. But I don't necessarily think the Defense Department goes in and sets up the next government. And when you saw that a shadow government was set up and basically being managed by people involved in the Defense Department was a concern to me personally. Mm-hmm. That's what the State Department does. Now, if you think the State Department are people who are a little squishy, then you ought to deal with that right up front. But then when you look at the shadow government that was sort of sitting over there, in either Roslyn or Crystal City, wherever it was, they had them. And then once they overthrow Saddam Hussein, and then you say, well, the guy that we thought we were going to put in to run the government, we think he may be a sort of bad guy. Mm-hmm. And so then we go in, we have his house raided. I mean, it's mm-hmm. things like that that I mean, I think that Secretary Rice came close several weeks ago where he said, look, you know, not disagreeing with what we did, but we may have made had a few miscues. Mm-hmm. That she was being honest about, sure. And then you sort of get a semi-going to the woodshed routine. Mm-hmm. But sometimes honesty is important, telling people, look, we're there, this is why we're there, we think it's important why we're there. Could we have done some things different? Yeah, because in a war, things change. I mean, the tactics on a field change as you go through it. And that's so my answer to your question is, I think the Iraq War, how it plays out, is going to shape this presidency, and it may be that this presidency doesn't get totally shaped until it's over, and the next president is in the White House, and we see how all this ends up. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's there. It's hard to imagine that this country is going to get, I mean, we talked about this earlier, really get. You know, focused and worried about Social Security reform when you're fighting a war in Iraq, because I think that's where a lot of the energy, resources, and money is going right now, mm-hmm. and you can't ignore that. And I think the war in Iraq has a lot of broader ramifications than just what's going on in that country. We're seeing it play out a little bit. I think in terms of energy policy, I think we're seeing it play out in terms of just our relationships. On the world stage with other countries, and so I think it is a very it's a very real issue. It's a very defining issue, and I think that is part of what that this administration has to figure out how they're going to manage it and deal with it. But it is, I think they're tied into that. The question I've got is what happens in November this year? I think it's going to be a fascinating election. I think it's a great one to cover. And mm-hmm. I'm happy to have the perspective I do, mm-hmm. because I've got an open Senate race in Tennessee. Bill Frist's seat is up, and I think it's going to be a fascinating Senate race where Congressman Harold Ford, a Democrat, is running, and it's a very tough Republican primary in Tennessee right now. I think it's going to be one of the seats that's going to be watched nationally as well. Mm-hmm. So I hope I answered your question as best I could.
Right. Do you have a question?
Did they hear the question? Could y'all hear that question about convergence?
Yeah, he has a microphone, right?
Do you?
Oh, you didn't bring it.
The question was, after I talked, we talked about convergence. Could you see the convergence idea that I sort of laid out inside a news organization working inside a White House? And I think the answer to the question is yes. Mm-hmm. But I think Martha touched on it earlier that the Clinton team. Whether you want to say it was a war room or whatever, I think they had put together a lot of these pieces, and had figured out how to really communicate through a number of these devices. That this administration, they're still there, but I don't think they're as interested in doing that. A White House has such a powerful podium that they present information from, that not to take it, you just sort of say it's a missed opportunity. But they could, you could take anything this president does and repackage it and put it out there, in every one of these formats. Think about a White House that says, all right, we're gonna blog ourselves all the time. So we've got this policy issue coming out, and so we're going to have Undersecretary so-and-so out here, and he's going to offer a blog that you can pick up, you can use, you can interact. I mean, you talk about managing the story. I mean, it is, you're stepping right into how the medium is changing, and you're right there in the forefront. What would you think if one night that the President of the United States, rather than doing the stand-up press conference in the East Room of the White House, does an online news conference? I mean, still manage the questions. that come in. But here he's sitting at his desk in the Oval Office, so you can see him, and he's doing a news conference online. What does that do for the broadcast people? I'm not sure, but I think there are ways to adapt everything that's going on and figure out how to use that, because the impact, the reach is going to be so much broader than it is today. And if part of what a White House does is you're trying to take that information and you're trying to sort of, you know, funnel it, you know, and sort of manage it, well, this opens up a way to do that. Because all of a sudden I've now taken the new ways that information gets put out there, and I've put my stuff into that funnel, and I'm managing that funnel. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to do that, because you can touch every place people get information, and you can do it just like that. I mean, I can sit there and put a podcast up real quick, so I've got the sound bites from the president that I want, and then, I mean, it's the whole notion of Ronald Reagan talking about, I'm going straight to the American people. I mean, you've gone right to them, because you can put out this podcast, and it is your excerpts. Now, you can choose to pick it up or not if you're the broadcast medium. But it doesn't matter. If you've got a computer, you can go in and you can listen to the President of the United States podcast right now.
Well, you can. The White House has a website that has Scott's briefing. Mm-hmm. You can get it as a transcript, but you can also watch it live some days.
Well, let me tell you what we just did, Martha. We do editorial boards, and we tape them. And as soon as it's over, and all we do is take the file, we do not edit it. We take the file as it was created, move it over into an audio program, and you can sit there, you can read our story, but you can listen to every piece of that editorial board online, mm-hmm. if you want to. I think it is, you know, that to me is where I think this is going. Uh-huh. Because what you were doing is we're bringing that listener inside the newsroom. Mm-hmm. You're sitting in that room with us because you're hearing the questions being asked, the intros as they get, when they're told, look, everything's on the record. I mean, you know, the whole nine yards. So it makes you feel like you're a participant. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think people are looking for, and the tools are there. Wait till we see the next campaign. Mm-hmm. I got to believe that you know, whereas as Howard Dean was talking about, you know, he was the guy who did all the stuff on the internet. We haven't seen anything with what you can do this mm-hmm. next time. I mean, you could sit there and be beaming out everything you're doing, and all of a sudden, I need TV commercials to do certain things. But can I target if I've got this list and I know I'm going to talk about this topic? And so I'm going to send you this, say, you know, get on your computer right now and look at this, or I'm going to take this piece I did, and I'm going to email it out to you to a targeted base of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is what this technology allows you to do. You can, and it is relatively inexpensive when you do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cost to us is laying a regular handheld digital recorder. It's all it is, mm-hmm. sitting on a table. Mm-hmm. And it's one person going in, and it's a piece of software sitting on a Mac G5, and it gets up, and that's all the expenses involved in it.
Mm-hmm. I know that somebody was telling me last week, who was involved in campaign politics, that there's a lot less money that is going to be spent on advertising,
right.
because there's so many ways of getting there. Well, tell one thing that tell us about is, as an editor, how do you feel the White House's presence? What kinds of things does the White House do to try to get to your newspaper?
Absolutely nothing. I'm serious. Nothing. And that's just been amazing. If I was there, and this is great because I can sit here, I can be the Monday morning quarterback, knowing what the tools are available to me today, compared the tools that were there when we were in the White House in 87, 88, I could, you know, if I'm looking at, let's take CAFTA, for example. We have some hosiery mills down in Fort Payne, Alabama, that were really worried about what was going to happen to them with CAFTA, mm-hmm. and with jobs, and with, you know, with socks and things that were going to go then, you know, out of their plant in Fort Payne, Alabama, down to Central America. Why would I not have said, well, we're monitoring this, because it's easy to monitor, not hard at all. And so we're going to say, we've got so-and-so and this person in the administration, we want to come in, we're going to give you an opportunity to talk to them directly. Now, I've got a Washington correspondence, one thing, but we can do it. Can you all take it online? Because we can do an online news event for you. The answer is yes, we can. And I bring that, you know, expert in. I mean, whoever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is still a lot of glamour when somebody says, "Wow, guess what? You know, so and so with the White House, you know, talked to me today." I mean, and it is important. I'm not trying to denigrate that. Although it was amazing to me in the White House to see some people who would love to have a White House operator place a call, because they knew that whoever's on the other end would take it because it's the White House calling. And that was their thrill for the day. And so, well, enjoy it while you can, because when you get out here, they're not going to talk to you for 1 minute. But you're just, but mm-hmm. anyway, but the White House, the persona of the White House is very important. But to be able to take that and target it in mm-hmm. and focus it, if I've got the majority of the United States Senate from Tennessee, which he is, and there's some issues working, and I want to come in and say, boy, I bet you if I can come in and make certain people available and we can move a story, and it's almost like an exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different exclusive. You know, when we were talking earlier about the White House press corps, why it's important, but the White House has the ability to get past that if they want to take it. And they want to come in and talk directly to us,
mm-hmm.
then, I mean, the technology allows you to do that. It doesn't get done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're missed opportunities in mm-hmm. my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really would like to be able to sit back and say, I can manage an issue. I can manage a message. I can figure out, you know, something that really is important to your readers, and I can target it in. And give you certain people to do it. I mean, it's out there. It happened. I wasn't being flip when I said absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's missed opportunities mm-hmm. in my mind. Mm-hmm. But you got to be willing. You know, I think you have to have a whole different media strategy
mm-hmm.
That you want to. You know, I hope Tony Snow's successful. It is more than changing the spokesperson.
Mm-hmm.
It is changing the way you approach issues, the way you present your information. I mean, a spokesperson is just that. A spokesperson is talking about issues that are out there, that are in, you know, out there in the public domain. The spokesperson doesn't all of a sudden say, okay, guess what? We now are no longer going to talk about Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is, do you also then rethink your approach, but also do you look at what are the policy options? And not saying go out and change them, but figure out what is it that you're trying to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's just I'm changing chairs, mm-hmm. it's not going to have an impact.
Don't you think that ultimately it's a question of persuading the president that more needs to be done in terms of explaining things to people?
Yes, I mean that is part of it, but at the end of the day, you do go back and say he was elected and you were not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of our goal, you know, when we sat down with President Reagan, one of the toughest conversations we had was at the end of Iran-Contra, walking in after he had written. I told you this story. He had written out in longhand on three legal-sized yellow pages what he wanted to say as the final words in Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm.
And once more, he wanted to go back and explain that I didn't trade arms for hostages and go through what we call the triangulation theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did this happen, which caused this, which was so convoluted, nobody understood it.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get there. And so we sat down, and he read this speech. We were sitting up in the family quarters of the White House. He read this speech, And Senator Baker turned to him and said, "Mr. President, it's a great speech, you can't give it." And he said, "Here's what we got to say." And what he did say, if you go back and look at it, was, you know, "The buck stopped here, mistakes were made, it's time to, you know, da-da-da." Said that, and the issue was over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he said that that he really believed that that he hadn't done
That's
anything.
Right.
But then the facts seemed to say otherwise.
That's
correct. And then he went on. And it's very, it was very interesting.
But
he said that he had done it.
Yeah, but that's what you have to do.
Right.
But if President Reagan had wanted to say, "Nope, I'm going to try to convince people I didn't do this, which caused that," then he was the president, he could have said it.
Mm-hmm.
And, what you hope is that in addition to some new players, that I have no sense, Martha, I'm just being very honest about it, of what advice and counsel this president receives. I've got to assume it's pretty good. But I hope that part of what is the change means that there's other, you know, other voices that are going to be
mm-hmm.
at the table.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I find, and it isn't just in a White House, I mean, I've seen it recently in Chattanooga, is that anybody who serves in an elected position needs to have somebody that's the contrarian.
Mm-hmm.
That will sit there and say, I hear you, but I want to make sure that you have this point of view as well. At the end of the day, the person's going to decide what they want to say and do. But you need that balance point, and you got to be willing. I mean, part of what I did for Senator Baker, I've served part of that role for him, and he would get angry with me at times in his own way.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, several hours later or whatever, you might come back and say, you know, I didn't like that, what you shared with me, but it sort of made sense, and we'll do such and such. But that's part of the job,
mm-hmm.
is you've got to be willing to lay out the range of options and have a tough enough skin that you can get it taken off every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody's got to do that.
Yeah.
Because there's too many people in government who are yes people.
Mm-hmm.
They want to sort of put the finger up and sort of gauge, what does the person want to hear? That's important, but you also got to have the people who put up the finger also and say, but I also got to make sure you get the full spectrum of what's there.
Mm-hmm.
So you know everything that's going on and as you make that choice and make that decision.
Mm-hmm. Towson, you got a question?
Coming from the journalist perspective, and also as a former White House communications official, what do you think that Tony Snow brings to this job as press secretary, and do you think he should be involved in policy making, and what does he also bring to journalists?
Good question, and it's something that Martha and I talked about before we started this, so let me sort of knock them off for you, and I think I'll knock them off for you pretty quick. Number one, I think that when the press secretary makes a point that I'm going to be, have asked to be, and been assured I will be part of the policymaking process, that you need to understand what that means. When we went in, Marlon Fitzwater, who was a good press secretary, there were times where he did not want to be in that room when everything was being ironed out. Because you've got to be able to tell and answer credibly when the press presses you on, when you're up at that podium, did you know such and such? Do you know this or that? And there is a fine line between being credible and lying.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to really walk that line carefully. So if you make a point to say, I was sitting in that room when that decision was made, and they ask you a question, and you sit there and say, I do not know,
mm-hmm.
then your credibility is in question. So I think he's got to find out where that balance point is and how to do, because the two parts of that work against each other. I mean, we were talking again before we started that when Larry Speaks was in the White House in the first Reagan administration, and the Grenada launch happened, and he got asked a question. He basically misled the media, mm-hmm. and he got really, really criticized for it. And because it sort of got acknowledged that he knew and he purposely had sort of misled him. So I think for Tony Snow, it's admirable he wants to be part of the party. As a communication director in the White House, I was not that person that stood behind that podium. I was much more involved in a lot of these decisions, but my job was to sit down and figure out how you communicated it, you used the various levers in the White House, how you would go out and do events and things wrapped around it, what the president was going to say if you had a Rose Garden event. I did not have to stand in front of the media and ask the question, do you know such and such? That is a real sticky wicket. Number two, it is also very important for Tony Snow to know as he goes in that he is no longer a working journalist. He is now a spokesperson for the White House, and that relationships that he has, and that are important relationships to him, whether it's with Fox News or anybody else in the media, they're very different that first day he stands behind that platform. And that this journalist who may be his longtime friend, when he asks a question, or if they're out someplace having lunch, and he asks him something, and if he volunteers something, and it appears on TV that night, or appears in a wire account or something, and he says, "My gosh, I thought this was off the record," that person says, "But you didn't tell me that." I mean, one of the first rules is, and I say this to my reporters in the newsroom today, when you talk to somebody, you make sure they understand how they're talking to you. So that if it is well understood, what does off the record mean? What does on background mean? All these little phrases, which are in the eye of the beholder, mean something different. That Tony Snow's got to make sure that if he's sitting down with Brit Hume, the first day he's on that job at lunch, he says, "Brit, you're my friend. How are we talking?" And if Brit Hume says to him, "All this is off the record," fine. But if he says, "Well," then your antenna better go up, because you now are a source of information and you're in a competitive game and everybody's chasing to be first. That's one of the other things the internet has caused. Everybody wants to be first. Sometimes the facts are left behind right. A little bit as they're being first. But that to me is a second part of this, is understanding the relationships that he has had before and that those relationships are very different now. And that he is talking to people in a very different way. There was a third part to your question. Can you remind me of the third? I know I hit two of them.
What will he bring the journalists?
Thank you. I hope what he brings is as an outsider, that he is able to help with inside the administration to understand how you can work with the media. And the media, while it's adversarial, it does not necessarily have to be combative all the time. And if he can bring that in and be more of a voice for how to work with the media, then I think that's a plus. And I hope he brings it, because he's been out there, as a working journalist, a journalist who's written about this White House, who shares some fairly pointed commentary about this White House, and I hope that's listened to. If not, but these are things that have to have been nailed down before he took the job, mm-hmm. and I have to trust he nailed them down, because once you get in the job, you can't do it. One of the most telling stories is if you look back in the early days of the Ford administration, when he came in after President Nixon resigned, and Gerald Terhorst came in as his press secretary. Gerald Terhorst, who had been with the Detroit News, if I remember right, or the Free Press, right, I think it was yeah. Detroit News, and he gets brought in, and all of a sudden, I don't remember what the issue, I think it was about the pardon of Richard Nixon. Right. And all of a sudden, there's a big falling out, and there's a big to-do, because he resigns. And that told me right there, and I think it's a great lesson learned, you need to have these understandings before you get in there. Because once you're there, it's a whole different world. And I hope he's nailed these down. And the last part is one of them that I hope's nailed down.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you all.